As Mary has said, our guest speaker today is Professor James Ogloff. James is the Director of Psychological Services at Victoria's Thomas Embling Hospital and Director of the Centre for Forensic Behavioural Science at Monash University. He's the Foundation Professor of the Centre and Director of the Psychological Services for the Victorian Institute of Forensic Mental Health, also known as ForensiCare. He was formerly the Director of Mental Health for British Columbia Corrections in Canada. And while in that role, he developed and implemented a comprehensive mental health service system for prisons, which included suicide screening and prevention programs. He has served as the University Endowed Professor of Law and Forensic Psychology at Simon Fraser University, also in Canada. And while there, developed and directed the program in law and forensic psychology. In his spare time, he's a prolific writer, having published 10 books and more than 135 scholarly articles and book chapters, and served as Associate Editor of Law and Human Behaviour, and currently serves on the editorial board of 9 additional journals. The professor has worked as a psychologist in a variety of clinical and forensic settings since 1984 and specialises in the area of mentally ill offenders, the assessment and treatment of offenders and medico-legal matters. We are delighted that he's been able to find the time to join us here this afternoon to talk about suicide, self-harm as we move into the opening of the ACT prison. And we hope to discuss with him his thoughts on this very important topic. Could we please welcome the professor?
Well, thank you very much. It is a pleasure to be here, and thank you for the kind introduction. I should say I'm here courtesy of Qantas, almost didn't make it, arrived 10 minutes early. So in any case, that's what happens. I should say it's heartening to be here, particularly to talk about this topic, which is a topic that is particularly tragic. Why is it heartening? Because certainly with the development of the Alexander McConachie Center, there has been a lot of attention paid to a variety of issues, particularly in health and mental health. And I think that's critical. I think it's also fortunate to use that name. We heard a bit about McConachie. The Australian Psychological Society has a college of forensic psychologists, and the award that's given annually to the best paper by a student receiving the doctorate is actually called the McConachie Prize for the same reason. So it's very interesting. There's a number of these people in the history of Australia and even New Zealand who had particularly different views which weren't well received at the time. The hospital where I work, the Thomas Embling Hospital in Victoria, which is our secure forensic hospital, is named after Thomas Embling. Thomas Embling was very much like McConachie. He actually came from the UK, England at the time, was a young doctor with bold ideas to change the then Yarrabend Asylum, to modernize it, and he lasted exactly 1 year, which was fortunate for him because he became incredibly wealthy once he left service of running that hospital. And in Victoria now, there are many streets and things named after him, and his house just resold, so he died, of course, many years ago. So I think picking up these names are very important because it does begin to set the tone. Now, turning to today's topic, of course, it's difficult to talk about things like suicide because it is particularly tragic. And I can tell you from experience, having worked my entire career primarily in prisons, there's nothing worse really in a prison than a suicide. The next most severe event would be prison riots. But suicides affect prisoners, they affect the prison employees, obviously families of the prisoner who committed suicide, and often the mental health staff and health staff there. So as anyone who's worked in prisons and mental health knows, I mean, there would be nights when I spent in a cell with somebody overnight, essentially sitting with them to try to ensure that the individual is not going to end his life. So we still see, though, in the papers, and in reviewing for this particular talk, I did see in the ABC's website that just a few months ago here in the ACT, a woman who was a psychologist who was going to be admitted to prison, she appeared at the magistrate's court for breaching a protection order in July this year. She ended up being remanded into custody and in court told the magistrate that she wanted to kill herself. While she was being transported to the Belconnen Remand Center, she attempted to take her own life. She remained alive for about 10 days and then did die as a result of her own injuries, self-inflicted injuries. So these are all too common occurrences. So what I want to do today, in the time available, is begin briefly by talking about, just so we're on the same page, what is suicide? You think that'd be a straightforward issue. It's not particularly in a correctional environment. I'm then going to contrast the suicide rate in the general population with that in prisons. I'm also going to emphasize that this mustn't stop at the prison door. I'll say that in most prisons, the way suicide's managed is essentially you make it impossible for the person to kill themselves. So if you've visited prisons, if you look at the cells where people are detained who are on suicide watch, they're called wet cells in Victoria. And these are wet cells because you can hose them out pretty easily. Everything in there is water resistant. So they're cells devoid of anything. There's typically a mattress which will be made of a kind of plastic material that can't be torn. There'll be no hanging points. The walls will be completely, of course, flat. Often if there is a toilet, it will be locked off. So most of these cells have the capacity to shut off a toilet so the individual can't get in the toilet. And they'll typically be monitored by video camera with intermittent visual checks. Sometimes, in the most extreme cases, we do see people stripped of their clothes entirely and given, again, a blanket that doesn't tear and not able to essentially strangle oneself with. So the fact is, prisons are actually quite effective at reducing suicide because one of the strategies is to make it impossible to kill yourself. The difficulty, as I'm going to say, though, is that those strategies are often the most ineffective. They are useful in the short term, but they're not useful in the long term. So we'll talk a bit about that as we go. So let me just begin by saying that just very quickly, when somebody dies in any setting and it's an unnatural cause, obviously some determination about the individual's cause of death is made. So for a death to be considered a suicide, there are generally three criteria that must be met. The first is it must be due to unnatural causes. The action has to be self-inflicted. And then finally, the person who injured themselves must have had the intention to die. Now that's straightforward, but it's very difficult in practice to evaluate. So an example in Victoria many years ago now is an individual was found hanged. He was quite suicidal, well known to the mental health service, and in fact had expressed the intention to die. So the individual was found hanging, in fact had died, and then sometime later a prisoner actually confessed to told a minister that he'd actually assisted the man in killing himself, and that the man, he in fact pulled his shoulders down to help him hang himself more quickly and effectively. The prisoner was subsequently found guilty of manslaughter for doing that, but that gives you an indication that at the time, even though it looked crystal clear like he'd intended to kill himself, that he was that it was self-inflicted, it was assisted by someone. Similarly, an individual might be found dead of unnatural causes. It might be very difficult to know whether it was self-inflicted or intentional. Okay, so that's just to give you some background. Now, in the general population, this is a breakdown by age for males and females. So just so everybody knows, the rate per 100,000 for men is average in Australia, about 11%. And you can see many more men kill themselves than women. This is thought to be because men use more lethal methods to kill themselves and are more successful. Now, the reality in prisons is it's actually quite a very positive story. So you may or may not know that since 1992, careful records are kept in all of Australia about deaths in custody and careful evaluations are made into suicide. And over that period, there has been a reduction in suicides. And if we take states such as my state, Victoria, in the last calendar year, there were no suicides in a prison system with 5,000 people on any given day. So there have been reductions overall in the completed suicides in custody, but across the country at the same time, the rate of suicides that do occur in custody are still between 2 and 12 times what we see in the general community. And as I've already hinted, the primary reason we see the reduction is because when an individual is identified to be at suicide risk, they're put in a situation where it's very difficult to kill themselves. In the job that you heard in my introduction, I was the head of mental health services for the British Columbia Prison Service. There were 20 prisons at the time and 80 community corrections offices. And my initial task really was to reduce suicide. That's why they established services. And I said, well, we can reduce suicide without question. But what it meant, just to give you an example, is in a prison population, again, of about 5,000 to 7,000 people, every year on suicide watch, we'd have about one-third of the prisoners under some sort of suicide watch. So if you think about what we call false positive errors, so you identify something like 2,500 people annually who are given some special attention, we did reduce the suicide rate until it was below the community rate. Right. Now, I was quite sad because very often, despite talking about what I'm talking about today, because the prison has to stop suicide, they do go to extreme measures. So they will stop the person killing themselves in the prison, but as we're going to hear, people kill themselves typically because they're distressed in prison. And the sometimes quite draconian acts to reduce the likelihood of them killing themselves produces greater distress over time. And I just want to show you about that now. Now, it's important to say that, not surprisingly, if you look at what are the suicide risk factors, they're essentially all found in the imprisonment context. The center that I run at Monash University last year was engaged by Department of Immigration to conduct a review of suicide and self-harm in the detention centers in Australia in order to help devise a plan, essentially, and an approach to reduce suicide and suicide attempts. And in that report, we had to emphasize that, obviously, the very act of putting people in detention is in fact, increasing the likelihood they're going to kill themselves. So when one had focus groups with detainees, sometimes, an example, this report's now made public, thanks really to the Australian that made an FOI request and the government then made it public. But we had a focus group with a number of people from a particular country, essentially all of them who were women basically cried and said they all think about killing themselves. That when you lose hope, when you're in an alien environment, that's what one thinks of. So prison, of course, sets that in motion. Now, obviously, in prison, people are in prison for a reason, and there are processes, fair processes, that get them there. But the health services and the care doesn't stop at the prison door. It mustn't. And I think very often in society, the societal view is that somehow prisoners are different from the rest of us. And obviously they are to some extent, but the reality is that they are part of the community. So the vast majority of people who will come into the new prison here will be back in the community in short order. So the effect of whatever happens to them in prison will be carried over into the community. So health, mental health, it's an opportunity when people are in prison to actually provide these services and to do them very well, because ultimately we save resources in the community. Now, just to give you a snapshot, this is based on data over approximately 5 years. Now, it's difficult for some people to see. This is the rate per 100,000 of suicides. Again, this is based on my state, Victoria. So in the community, these are general people in the community. I mentioned about 11 people per 100,000 commit suicide. It's, it's about 1% of the population. Now, what happens is, in prison, that actually goes up. Now, it doesn't look dramatic, but it actually is multiple times. Now, why I have this particular graph is because I want to also focus on community. So this is the rate of suicide while people are supervised in the community, and if you can't see it, it's about 250 per 100,000. So one of the things that's well known, and I'm happy to say that in Australia there's been some recent excellent research in this regard as well, is that the likelihood of an individual committing suicide exponentially increases in the time after which they're discharged. And what happens very often is that, obviously, prison services, you have the responsibility of taking care of people while they're in their custody, and that's well established in law. then there's greater difficulty in providing services when they're discharged. Yet, as we see just from this is really a much bigger problem. And so certainly one hopes that within the ACT, there will be aftercare systems in place. I did some research many years ago, 20 years ago now. We started a large mental health program in a new prison. It was very exciting, just like here. And one thing we found, we actually had pretty good success in the prison. We reduced suicide. We reduced harm to others. We had a lot of positives. But what we found when we began to track people who left prison is they were left with despair, distress, and misery. And for example, those who were mentally ill, 60% of the most unwell got no mental health care once they left prison. So we had quite a fantastic prison service, but nothing when they left. And so it's not surprising then that the return to community is equally distressing. And imagine in the place of these individuals, often you're separated now from family. You have very little chance of getting employment. Housing will be difficult. Money's difficult. Embarrassment, shame, all of these things. And very often people do end up saying, it's just too difficult, take their lives. And of course, there's no sort of protection as there would be in a prison. So how can we begin to rectify this situation? Well, let me just begin by saying that it's actually very important to note that, again, in Australia, there's been some leading research in the area. And one of the very helpful studies that's been done, actually, you can't read that probably, but it compared a large number of individuals, about 90 individuals, who had seriously attempted to kill themselves and almost succeeded, and compared them with individuals who actually had not had any suicide attempt history in prison. And naturally, they found, you know, to make a long story short, greater levels of distress in all regards for those who are attempting to kill themselves. So as you can see there, higher levels of coping problems, fewer resources, poor relations with staff, with other prisoners, more likely to have been victimized in the prison. And what this points to then is when we look at reducing suicide, both in prison and post-prison, the focus has to be on current distress, not on just the physical harm, and not on past indicators. So one of the great problems that I see is when one goes and looks at how are people screened when they come to prison, we typically still, and this included DEAC, we still, when people come in, would ask them, you know, have you seen a psychiatrist? Do you have, you know, are you mentally ill? Have you tried to kill yourself in the past? Are you thinking of killing yourself now? That would roughly be it. Now, as this points out, that's not helpful. It's really current distress. So the gist of the argument is that in developing prison services, what we need to do is essentially reduce the overall level of distressful situations and at the same time enhance the likelihood that the individual will be able to develop in that prison. I mean, we want people to be rehabilitated in the prison process. We certainly don't want them to be further damaged. And we certainly don't want, because obviously that'll end up in damage to other people in the community. And at the same time, we want them to be have their ability to be more resilient and to be able to cope better, both in the environment and the community. So the fact is, although the rate is obviously greater, it's so low, so few people kill themselves in prison, that the strategy of trying to identify which of the, say in Victoria, 5,000 prisoners might kill himself or herself this year, that's essentially an impossible task. So that's what happens. Again, from my experience in British Columbia, with between 5,000 and 7,000 prisoners, again, it's simply impossible to pick out the one or two who will commit suicide in any year. Okay? And in a prison service like Victoria, one suicide per year in prison means it's actually double the population in the community. So, because obviously suicides were low. So we're misguided when we try to put all of our eggs in the basket of identifying the one or two individuals who might commit suicide. That's important, but at the same time, it's taking a public health approach to reducing the overall level of distress. And what I mean by the public health approach is actually doing what we do in public health. So if you think about wearing seat belts, for example. Now, when I was growing up, people didn't wear seat belts. My wife's one of seven, and being the seventh, she was in an apple crate in the back of the family station wagon until she was about eight. That's what happened. Everybody, lots of people here will remember this. So people didn't have seat belts, high road tolls and so forth. Now, no one said, okay, we're going to have a law where the erratic drivers or the people who speed have to wear seat belts. So there wasn't a check that, you know, every morning when you get up, it was, how are you feeling today? Do you feel like you'll speed or drive erratically or talk on your mobile phone while you're driving? And if you are, then wear a seatbelt, and we'll put a sign on your car saying, others around me should wear seatbelts. No, what we do is everybody wears a seatbelt, so the road toll goes down, right? Less people die, even if they're in an accident. Similarly, in prisons, the sensible way to reduce distress and suicide is to try to take a public health approach to incarceration. And what this means is actually reducing the levels of distress. Prisons have a place for removing people from the community, but at the same time, it's not to torture individuals or to make their lives particularly miserable. And the consequences that are very negative. So this is the overall approach. And I realize a lot of people will be, you know, particularly people who have loved ones who've been maybe killed or injured by somebody who's in prison, have difficulty with this because they'll say, well, they don't deserve this, that they deserve things like punishment. And the only answer to that is that that's perfectly understandable. I have three children, and if they were injured or killed, I would feel that way too. But one needs to take in a society a big picture and say that the goal is to reduce offending in the population. And the only way to do that is to actually treat people differently in those environments so that when they're released, they actually are rehabilitated. And services, prison services that do that now reliably reduce reoffending. So it makes the community safer. It makes the prisoner safer as well. Now, these approaches work. So this is Victoria. Victoria has a very good system, and in fact, components of the system in Victoria are being picked up here in Victoria. As you can see here, this is the suicide rate in prison, which some years is actually down to zero now. And this is just over the last 5 years. So it started out being about five times the general population, and in some years it's in fact zero. And partly what they do in Victoria is they adhere to the principles that I'm talking about. Now, the other thing to interject, and we heard again from Mary's introduction, is that the... this machine, there we go. This is just ideas that one of the things that happens in the contemporary society is that prisons are governed by rights and principles. And so there are a range of principles that we need to pay attention to. And obviously, these are principles that are derived from, for example, the United Nations, but also local rights legislation. And the sad thing is that very often they're simply words without meaning. And I could tell you story after story in my work, going to Western Australia, for example, and seeing a young man who in 1999 was found unfit to stand trial because he was mentally ill. There's only a small number of psychiatric beds in WA, so he was moved to a prison and spent 6 years in prison, 2 years in solitary confinement, locked down 23 hours a day. And what was his crime for which he was found unfit to stand trial? He tried to steal cigarettes from a woman in the city, in the town square. She put her hand on his, he punched her, police came. That individual was eventually released after a lot of effort. But the idea is that these are often hollow words. So it's important in developing a new prison that we realize that prisoners do have rights. They also have responsibilities. But just like a child, we can't teach children to be better by treating them worse. You know, this simply doesn't work. We know this from years of experience. Okay, just winding down then, how do we actually improve the situation? Well, again, the positive news is a real opportunity exists here in the ACT with the development of this new prison. And so there are a range of areas to be addressed, which I'm going to speak briefly about. And the starting point really is making sure that there is, a solid health and mental health service. And I certainly understand that that's being done and in place. And that is the starting point, because the strategy is really right from the beginning of admission to the prison for the health team to get to know the individual and for the individual prisoner to know that there are services and people to turn to. So one of the things is an intake mental health and suicide screening approach. And I have, over many years, developed with colleagues such an instrument that's used in many, many different prison services around the world. And this is simply an intake screening process where a mental health professional, not a prison officer or a general nurse, but a mental health professional, psychiatric nurse, in some jurisdictions, other mental health professionals do it, actually sit down, it's only about 20 minutes, and do a brief psychiatric screen and look at levels of distress and risk for suicide. What then happens is triage and follow-up of people who actually are identified as being at risk. The environment's also critical, and again, great care is taken in the new institution here for that. But by environment, I just don't mean things like the walls and the buildings. I actually mean access to families and supports, instilling hope and responsibility. So in the secure hospital that I am a director of, we're very clear to our patients and secure prisoners that come that, you know, the behavior you've engaged in is obviously inappropriate and proper, and a lot of the effort is on addressing head-on their offending, including their attitudes and so forth. But at the same time, it's instilling hope for the ones that will be released that there is a future. And obviously engagement and meaningful activities as well. So it's increasing the level of positive supports, decreasing the level of distress generally. It requires well-trained staff, not only well-trained, staff that adhere to these values. It's very difficult, and again, over many years in prisons, I can tell you the first prison I worked in, the psychologists were despised. There were the prisoners, and the psychologists were slightly above the prisoners. And so we would have things like our cars would be keyed. We would be. I was once in a lift in a high-rise prison, which was you get into a prison. In prison, modern times, you have no control over the environment, so doors open automatic and so forth. You get into the lift, and it was basically stuck for about 30 minutes. And it was just someone having me on that, you know, seeing how much I would be able to tolerate this. Now, that's changed dramatically now to the point where many mental health professionals fit in very well in prisons, and in fact, in our modern prison officer is in fact the greatest asset in dealing with these problems because they get to know the offender and the offender's background. So staff training, intervention, as I've already mentioned, ranging from crisis management, but also minimizing restrictive environments. That's important. It works in the short term, but it doesn't work in the long term. It's like a child again. If you want to stop the child over time from fighting and engaging in difficulty, you don't beat them and lock them in a closet. We know that that has long-term problems, but that's still what we do in prison. We don't beat people, but we do lock them in what's effectively a closet. And sometimes, although we don't beat them physically, we still do beat them emotionally. So a woman I deal with in Victoria, who's actually was a science major, 130 IQ, isn't given books to read. So when she's in solitary confinement, she has nothing. And for her, that's like taking her life away. She's got nothing to read and so forth. The other thing that's very important is case management approach. This is prison officers in particular getting to know and having responsibility for a manageable number of people so they do get to know them. Again, when I started in prisons, prison officers and prisoners didn't speak. They now do. You want the prison officer to be able to know, not the intimate details of the person's life, that's unrealistic and probably not helpful, but they do want to know that, okay, you had a visit with your girlfriend, it didn't go well, she's told you she's going to leave you. That individual needs to be able to talk to somebody. Those are the circumstances under which people often commit suicide. And, of course, suicide prevention programs have been very successful, and these programs have been aimed not at simply removing, the dangerous impediments around them, but actually increasing over time their capacity. Let me just end with a quote from a colleague of mine who is our professor of forensic psychiatry in Victoria. And this is something he wrote about almost 10 years ago. Placing potentially suicidal prisoners in isolation cells, stripped of furniture, clear of hanging points, and subject to the constant gaze of prison staff may be a cheap and in a very short term effective suicide prevention strategy, but should remain unacceptable to a mental health professional concerned with the state of mind and long-term mental health of the patient. Thank you very much.